forever. Dog.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writer's Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the Pop Culture Witches Panel. Give yourselves a round of applause just for showing up. You did it. Hi, my name is Ben Blacker. I'm a writer. I currently have this book coming from Vertigo Comics. It's called Hexwives. It's coming out on Halloween. You're right to applaud. I think we're good to go. Please, let's give a round of applause to today's coven of witches, starting with Jill Thompson, creator of Scary Godmother. The editor of the fantastic Image Comics Redlands, Heather Antos. Another Vertigo Comics writer, her Goddess Mode is coming out in December. Please welcome Zoe Quinn. And finally, actor you know from The Tick, among many other programs, including Blair Witch, and I think she has some witchy secrets as well. Please welcome Valerie Curry. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it. I gave some of your credits already, but I want to just go down the line. We are recording this for the Writers Panel podcast, available on iTunes. And I want the listeners to know what your witch credentials are. Why are you on this panel? Where are the witches in your life? Starting with you, Jill.
Well, you already made mention to everybody that I am the artist, writer, creator of The Scary Godmother, which you may have seen on Cartoon Network or from the fine books by Dark Horse Comics.
Those are great books.
You don't force them, but I would hope to win them over by the end of the panel.
They're shy. They're shy.
I believe I'm on this panel because of The Scary Godmother, but also... Anytime I'm wearing black and riding my bicycle in Chicago, I have had a school bus full of kids go out the window at me. So I believe I'm on this panel because of my profile.
Zoe.
I'm Zoe Quinn. As you said, I'm a fellow member of the new Vertigo lineup, and I'm writing a magical girl cyberpunk comic called Goddess Mode. Aside from that, I actually run a digital coven, which we lovingly refer to as the Midnight Society because we are very serious adults. And in general, I have like weird... I know it's shocking with a last name like Quinn, but I actually I'm Irish, and we have like a long, weird genealogy going back where allegedly one of my ancestors got burned at the stake, and I feel weird like pride in the fact that my family seems to have a type.
I'm Heather Antos, and I'm the editor of the Image comic Redlands, which takes place in the spooky state of Florida. A lot of crazy things happen there, I'm told. I guess my witch cred, I'll say, is the first movie I ever watched where a character shared my name was Blair Witch. And that was a fun realization to have.
And you yourself are a powerful woman, of course.
Well, I hear that's what you call powerful women.
That's right.
That's right.
We'll get into it. Valerie.
I'm Valerie Curry. I am an actor, and I have had the opportunity to play a lot of women with powers, including currently Dot on The Tick. Yes, thank you. And I'm also one of those powerful feminist women that gets called a witch, and I'm also a practicing witch and pagan. So I have all the opinions.
Yeah, let's start with that.
That's true. Great. Actually, I do have my juju crystal medicine bag with me all the time. It's in my bag. So,
how many people in this room have crystals on them? Anyone?
Yeah. More than you would think.
Fewer than I thought, actually.
More than in an average setting. Valerie, what does it mean in this day and age to be a practicing witch?
Paganism is it's nature-based spiritual practice that comes in all sorts of different flavors. Some people are lay pagans. Some people do practice witchcraft. or use their own terminology. As everybody knows, it's pretty individual. For me, that is pretty individual, and it has been for about 10 years, although I do work with a group in Brooklyn, and am actually the owner of an apothecary called Light and Havoc that we started this last year, making anointing oils, smoking blends, all sorts of fun things. Thank you. But what it means to practice witchcraft is, I think it's different for everybody, but I think what it shares is a sense of personal revelation as spiritual authority, and that can mean working with the land, working with spirits, working with yourself in more or less abstract kind of ways. For some people, that's sort of a hard reality, the other world, spirits, gods, whatnot. And for some people, it's archetypal, and it's a little bit more of a Jungian delve. I hope that wasn't too weird and heady an explanation for that.
No, that is no more weird or heady than any religion that we know about.
Right? You know, yeah. And I really think, and I'm sure this is what we're going to talk about a lot, but I think that with the current trend of witchcraft and magic, so much of that is about female empowerment and women looking for spiritual traditions they can delve into that aren't based in patriarchy, which most organized religions are. Yeah. We have very few options if we don't want to engage in religions that have or ask a lot of cognitive dissonance of us.
Yeah, Zoe, I think you were telling me that you sort of had that upbringing that veered away from patriarchal religion and went towards some more witchy stuff, right?
Yeah, I kind of grew up in the Appalachians, so there's it's Appalachian biker culture, which is so specific and definitely a background I've seen represented.
When you say that, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right, it's weird, but there is weird American folk magic built into biker culture, like the custom of gremlin bells, which is I just found one on my bike one day because you can't do it yourself, otherwise it kind of breaks the thing. And you somebody ties a tiny bell to the bottom of the undercarriage of your motorcycle, and it's supposed to basically make it so that if you're ever in trouble, another biker will come help you, which was weird that randomly appeared on my bike, and the first time I was in trouble, another biker did come and help me. But aside from that, I was kind of raised with this stuff, and I very much obviously got out of the very small town that I came from, and I'm sort of rediscovering my roots. And try to remember some of the problem with my family's line, though, is that everything seems to be oral traditions, which means when the Catholic Church decided that they wanted to basically monopolize wet medicine and get rid of any of the people that were already practicing, which were usually women, usually older or indigenous people that were being colonized, they just kind of erased all of that and pretended it didn't exist. So I'm part of the Celtic Reconstructionism type of practicing, in addition to just having my little digital coven, where we a lot of it's kind of that archetypical. We learn tarot and do astrology and stuff because as a way of coping with the fact that everything's on fire and kind of a nightmare. And sometimes you need to just be oh God, space is ruining my life, because you don't know space's face, and you don't have to see space on the news all the time messing with you. And if nothing else, it's always been, whether it's tarot, astrology, or any of these sort of things, it's I saw a really good joke by one of the coven members was saying basically this is basically what queer people who were too poor to afford therapy have been doing.
Jill, you mentioned having crystals in your pocket.
Yep.
What does that do for you? I want to sort of dig in on the nuts and bolts of some of these ideas and talk about that before we move on to more of the pop culture stuff. What does having crystals in your pocket do for you?
Well, I feel it enhances. Well, that's my creature from a Black Lagoon.
And same thing.
And then here's my medicine bag with my stones and my crystals mm-hmm. in it. I feel it kind of amplifies me. That's the simple sentence
okay.
of it. So all the things that I like about me and all my strength and all the ways that I interact with the world, I feel like it kind of gives me a little boost, like a battery pack for it.
Yeah.
And everything I've ever read about some stone or crystal that I've been drawn to is something that I actively feel like, not, I don't know if embody is the right word, but put into use.
Mm-hmm.
I the only blue stone I like is ultramarine, but certain blue stones in different things are throat chakras, and I love to tell stories, and I like to tell stories in different mediums, and I like to do different voices when I'm telling a story and act things out, and I always feel like I'm I don't know if anybody else in this room feels like I get energy from other people. Like, I am a hugger, and I don't want to invade your personal space, but I really feel it recharges my battery. But also, when I'm at my table, I've had other people work for me, and they say that they can see people leave more energized when they go away from my table. So sometimes I feel super drained, and I feel like I'm giving them as much positivity as I possibly can, or try and connect with every single person that I meet. So and I also believe that there's an energy in the earth, that we're electrical beings, and that we've put a lot of concrete over things that could kind of help restore us. So you have to walk around in nature on your bare feet to help you get back in alignment with the earth. I'm a big kind of believe a lot of things about the earth. We're the earth is the giant organism, and we are the things that are living on it, much like we get a virus or we get a something. And I feel, you know, it's just kind of this cycle that goes around.
Yeah.
So we have to treat the earth well, so then we can be, you know, we can live off of her and be, so I'm trying to make sure that everything in me is working in a good order so I can give off the best thing that I can.
Yeah, I think no matter what you call it, that's a good thing to believe. Valerie, I want to jump back to you before we move on and just talk about sort of the practicalities of practicing witchcraft. And like, what does it look like? What are the holidays? What do you do on them? What do the rituals, what do the practices look like?
Oh, that's a lot to answer.
And again, pick and choose.
Yeah, just in a snippet,
bullet
please.
Points.
In a snap. It's different for everybody. And I would love to say that it's like super consistent. Every morning I sit down at my altar and I ground it up, but it's not true. You know, it ebbs and flows like everything else, and life gets in the way. But for me, it does consist of like, of taking that time, and you know, I'm in a better headspace every time that I do sit down and ground and connect with, you know, with my guides. I also work a lot with my ancestors before I move out into space. So that's kind of like the daily habit of staying connected. Mm-hmm. In terms of holidays, I also practice from a more Celtic informed space, so I don't necessarily do like the sort of traditional Wiccan like 8 holidays a year, but they're it's more, you know, we got Samhain coming up on Halloween. That's a big one, right? And that's my favorite. You know, for me, that's a really old Irish tradition called a Dumb Supper that I like to host, where you're essentially having a silent feast with either alone or with people around you, and you're inviting the spirits of your beloved dead to be with you, and you set a place for them, and you invite them in. And for some people, it can get kind of scary, you know? But that's sort of the most... That's the most ghosty stuff, but for the most part, it's a process of staying connected, and it's a word that is appropriative, so I don't like to use it, but essentially doing sort of shamanic like practices, journey work kind of things, in order to stay connected and continue to evolve, and also like say like fight the patriarchy when you can't do anything else because they have a majority.
And one thing to keep in mind, too, is, like, there's so many different kinds of magic and witchcraft with a bunch of different names from a bunch of different cultures. Wicca, as it's usually termed, is, like, more of an eclecticism, but not everybody practices that. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, mine's very rooted in my specific culture and where I come from and my background. And there are a lot of people of a lot of different backgrounds. So there's not one standard witch thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to have an understanding and appreciation and respect of the culture that if you are an eclectic practitioner of the ones that you're borrowing from, and to basically always be a good house guest and not be like, oh, this is mine, and leave it at that, too. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for putting that much better.
There is something, and part of the reason I wanted to, only a small part of the reason I wanted to play with witches in this comic, Hexwives, is unlike other horror quote-unquote monsters, there's no Frankenstein for witches. There's no Urtext for witches. It's sort of a collection of tropes. And Heather, I wanted to talk to you. You know, Redlands sort of picks and chooses from those tropes, as I think we all do, Scary Godmother does as well. But what were the conversations early on with Jordy and with the creative team about what witchcraft looks like in this world?
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely picked and chosen from a lot of different variations of which I cannot speak.
Oh, this is the perfect place for you, then.
Witchcraft. That's a hard word. Lots of hard C's. And Jordy is from Florida, and so she, you know, she leans into some of the more like Southern ghost stories, but she lives in Ireland now, and so there's a lot of history there with Irish ghost stories and Celtic magic. And we've kind of developed our own rule set to stay grounded in our world. We wanted it to be a more organic story, because I think what was more important for her was not the fact that these women were witches, but the discussion of power amongst people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no coincidence that women with power have been labeled monsters, because look who's doing the labeling. Valerie mentioned a little bit ago about how we're sort of having a witch moment in popular culture. And Jill, I feel like you were sort of at the forefront of this witch moment. When did you start doing Scary Godmother, and why was this a trope you wanted to tackle?
I started Scary Godmother, and the first Scary Godmother book came out in 1996 when I was 3. And
prodigy, you're just a prodigy.
I've done a series for HarperCollins called Magic Trixie, and that's about a little witch and her monster friends. She's not as adept as magic; she's still learning. It's kind of fun. Whereas Scary Godmother is someone who knows all of the witchcraft, and she's kind of like the Queen of Halloween type of thing. But once I started writing her, she's the main character. It's the characters around her that take up all the fun stories. She's kind of the straight man in it, which is weird because I'm usually the Lucille Ball of things, especially when it comes to falling down. But I started Scary Godmother. I've always loved spooky things, even though I was the biggest scaredy cat as a kid. But my go-tos have been, you know, superheroes, mutants, specifically the X-Men. My first issue, okay, this is going to veer off a little bit into superheroes.
We have time.
But my first huge obsession of superheroes was as a curly-haired 13-year-old girl who lived outside of the city of Chicago, accidentally picking up an old copy of the John Byrne, Chris Claremont X-Men, which was specifically issue 129, Run for Your Life, Kitty Pryde, and saw myself running down an alley in the city of Chicago, and then used her budding mutant powers to save all the super badass superheroes that were in there. And then there was a Jean Grey, White Queen telekinetic bitch fight happening at the very end, which was like, oh, I want to be everyone in this comic. It didn't matter like if it was male or female, but I just thought my first role model growing up was Julie Newmar Catwoman. And then I was like, okay, so I want to be 6 feet tall and red-haired and wear that costume all day long. And oh, well, maybe I want to wear a green costume with big thigh-high gold boots all day long too. Oh, I can be both of those. And then, oh, wait, I also always feel like a witch. It was just something that I always felt like, and then so I kind of just mixed everything together that I really liked, and I don't know, it's like I identify as a witch all the time, so it's just something that I realized I should make something with. It's like another comic book artist at one point said, Jill, why don't you ever make a comic of your own, when I was working on a bunch of other people's comics. Like, I don't have a good idea. I said, I draw a lot of things that are really fun, and I sketch out things that are interesting, and, you know, it might be like, oh, well, this character does this, or they have this type of power, or this is a superhero, or this is, you know, a mystery character. But there was never a story to go behind it, and Scary Godmother just happened by accident, and it was a culmination of all the things that I like. My first niece was going to be born, and at the time, I dressed a lot more goth than I do now, and my hair was a lot bigger than it was than it is now. And I said the sentence, "Oh, I can see myself standing in the back of the church, a Catholic church. I'd be a pretty scary godmother." And I said those words together. It was a literal light bulb over the head, or maybe a cauldron over the head. And I saw a teeny little, like, witch fairy Tinkerbelly type mm-hmm. thing, sketched her out immediately. The next day, sketched her out again, and she became pretty much what you saw as Scary Godmother. And then I started doing the improv trope, which is I've trained to do improv. I used to be in an improv troupe. You start asking questions, and if you have questions to answer, you can create a story. So I was like, well, okay, she's your scary godmother. What does she do? Oh, well, she shows you that it's not, it's okay to be scared sometimes, but also that spooky things are kind of fun. And where does she live? Well, she lives in a haunted house. Well, who lives there with her? Well, monsters. And what kind of monsters? Oh, my mom used to tell me to watch out for the bugaboos under my bed. Bugaboo, he works under your bed. And it started writing itself. Yeah. And if you sit down with a blank piece of paper and say, oh, I'm going to create the best thing ever today, you probably won't create anything. Yeah. But if you're riding your bike or cooking dinner and suddenly you see the light hit something across the street in a certain way, it might make you have an idea. So my ideas never come up from me trying to sit down and make up a certain thing, but it's always from me trying to answer a question. Yeah. And then I brought a lot of myself to it. So it's just kind of like this big mixture of happy accidents and personal interest.
I think that you raise an important thing that, like, you know, you can't set out to just create something. I think it comes from somewhere, right? This was an accumulation of ideas, of things you loved. And I think the thing we all do as creators is we write autobiography. You know, we may layer metaphor on top of it. We may layer genre on top mm-hmm. of it. But we're writing autobiography. And Zoe, I wanted to talk to you about that for Goddess Mode specifically. What's the autobiography in this book? And can you give just sort of a two-sentence logline for people who don't know about it yet?
Sure. So so it's basically a cyberpunk magical girl comic, but that's like the dress-up of it. Mm-hmm. The real story, though, is about trying to fight for a better world when it's like kind of trying to fix a car while you're driving it, and also it's simultaneously running you over. And you are one very small person trying to fix a very big world that has made you inherently disadvantaged at fighting that because it's had that impact on you. So you find other people to try to do this with, and they are similarly kind of screwed up in that same exact way. So how the hell do we actually, like, end up? It's like, you know, all the new Vertigo books kind of have like an idea of something that's that needs to be fixed with the world. Mine's more focusing on who's doing the fixing, what that does to you, and maybe like how we might end up replicating, how we should maybe stop playing a losing game and start making some new rules ourselves, because we're never going to win at something that's automatically setting us up to fail. And for me, technology was a big part of that. The first time I've discovered, I think one of the biggest reasons I'm weird outside of like being raised in as a weird woods kid was that someone gave me a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook on a floppy disk when I was a little kid.
Floppy disk.
And I had access.
Just one?
Just
20.
One. I remember it was like a little beige thing, and it just had like a red Sharpied A on it.
Sorry, Zoe. What's a floppy disk?
Really? That might indeed be interesting to try and explain.
But to me, it was like, that was magic, because I couldn't, like, you know, the nearest neighbor was really far away. I was trapped in a small town, but this gave me a portal into basically a whole other world where I could actually talk to and find my weirdos. And then when I found it was writable, that I could create things and have an impact on the world. Like me, this depressed, weird, queer, sad person that's like surrounded by nothingness, and managed to pull myself into an actual place where I wanted to be through that. It's like that kind of tied into so much of the magic stuff that I was raised with, this kind of like using it as a mentality, like this ritual care for other people as a way to better yourself and to make yourself a more compassionate person and to express care and to help and let them know they're cared for and that sort of thing. So it was like, it was power. And I think, you know, for the same reason that any person that is not already in power that is maybe getting some seems threatening to those who have it, because it's frequently viewed as a zero-sum game, which it doesn't really have to be. I think that molding that into the magical girl stuff I grew up with, which was the first time I saw queer characters in anything. Thank you, Sailor Moon, my God. even though my biggest encounter with Sailor Moon was getting fan dubs fan subs on VHS tapes from my first girlfriend, who then stole them from me when we broke up. So I didn't have to deal with the cousins weirdness for a long time. But you know, wrapping it in that kind of mashing all of those things together, I'm still trying to figure out the single sentence for that reason, because this book is so many things to me.
Yeah,
and each one of the girls, like, the witch archetype, if we're talking about like the Jungian thing, is the only one where it's very feminized, and it's the only one whose power doesn't come from their relation to a dude. You know, they're not the maiden, the mother. The crone is her own person. Mm-hmm. And one of the coolest things about that sort of thing is the relationship building with other women and other people who are being screwed over. Magic is sort of ultimately the ability to better yourself and others through sidestepping unfair garbage that you had never had a chance of getting past because the rules are broken. And magical girls are cool, and I really, really wanted to have awesome outfits while
and it's,
which is always good.
And it's a beautiful looking book. I mean,
yeah, Robbie is amazing.
So the concept is great. The art is just amazing. So people should. Is it available for pre-order right now?
It is available for pre-order at your local comic book shops.
Yeah.
And Midtown Comics online, and I don't know when it's on comics.
Yeah, it's on like Amazon and stuff, but people should check it out.
I'll be yelling about it on Twitter literally forever.
Yes. While we're on the subject of autobiography, Valerie, I want to jump to you and talk about some of these roles that you have played, where you've gotten to play magic people.
Yeah.
And do you, as an actor, have to find the you in some of these more outlandish roles? And what has that process been like?
I think as an actor, the me is like, it's unavoidable. You know, I'm my own instrument, so everything is going to get expressed through this instrument. But I really do tend to think of the characters that I play as like disembodied entities. You know what I mean? That like just need care. You know, and expression. I think the sort of one of the unifying elements, though, to the characters that I played and that I'm really the most drawn to are women who whose motivation is not to be liked. It does not make them unlikable per se, but you know, whatever the fuck that means.
I think that's an important distinction, though.
Yeah. Well, it's written into so many female characters in pop culture, like the overwhelming number of female characters, and the characters are asked to be likable, the actresses are asked to be likable in the portrayal of those characters, and I have no energy for that. I don't, and so I just tend to be drawn to women who have their own, they're pursuing their own agency if they don't already have it, and kind of, as you were just describing with the archetypes, whose power isn't defined by the men around them. That's been the unifying element. And sometimes they're magical and sometimes they're not. You know what I mean? Like, I don't look at a character differently because she's a vampire than if she's not a vampire. You know what I mean? She just has a different diet. that's all just environment. So that's, I think, sort of the unifying element. And I think that we have an easier time as a culture embracing women and as characters who are like that when they do have, they're othered by power, by a supernatural power, which, you know, I think it has its advantages and it has its disadvantages culturally. You know, I love seeing magical or powerful or superpowered women in film and TV. I love consuming it, you know, but at the same time, I'm really hungry to see that then translated into female characters who are not supernatural, but because I don't think we have that yet. In many ways, it's like we have to have women who are living in an almost an alternate reality in order to not have them obey the rules of likability. You know what I mean?
That's a really interesting point. And for you creators there, yeah.
Yeah, creators.
For you creators who are in this room or listening to this podcast, you have your marching orders. Go make this stuff. One more question about autobiography. Heather, as the editor on a book, do you feel like you're getting to put yourself into it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, like, Jordy and I, we have a lot of, like, powwow Skype sessions, 3 a.m. phone calls, for one of us. I don't know. Time zones are weird. But yeah, I mean, there's though Jordy's credited as the writer, I feel like, you know, even Clayton is the letterer. Like, there's so much of, like, him that he puts into it. And I think, you know, between Jordy's experiences, mine, Vanessa's, everyone who works on it, you know, I like to sum up the book as the discussion is that your anger is justified, but your actions aren't always based on that anger. And, you know, there's a lot to be angry about in this world. And there's a lot, I think, for women specifically to be angry about in this world. And, you know, so working on a book that is about angry women seeking justification and seeking revenge and, you know, it's such a cathartic process to get to work on these scenes and, you know, spoiler, right some wrongs. It's so cathartic to get to work on that. I remember when Jordy and I were sitting out and plotting out the last issue of the first arc, like, I cried reading that script because it was just like, that is everything I've ever wanted to do, you know. But you can't, because I like life outside of prison, and apparently arson is illegal. Who knew? But yeah, no, I feel like, you know, when you're comics are collaborative, you know, and every single person who works on a book, like, if you just sit down and have a conversation, you change the drop of ink on the page. You know, your heart and soul is in every bit of that book just as much as anyone else's.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and I think it does, you know, occasionally get brought up on these Comic-Con panels, but it's worth saying that, you know, this is a highly collaborative medium, and everyone who participates in it ideally has a voice in it. You know, I assume that you are one of the best editors that Jordy has worked with, and my editors at Vertigo are, you know, Molly and Maggie have as much a voice in this book as the artist, as I do, as the colorist does. And it makes a difference. It makes it a more honest book. I want to make sure that we have time for questions from you all. If you have a question, please line up at this microphone. Do that now. When you get to the microphone, please adjust it so it's in front of your mouth. Thank you. In the meantime, I'm going to ask you, I have a heavy question and I have a light question.
Perfect.
I'm going to ask you the heavy question first, since Heather sort of touched on it. It's been a terrible week. It's been a terrible month. It's been a terrible couple of years. It's been a terrible, you know, 240 years. What are you all doing for yourselves? What are you doing with your anger, with your sadness, with your high emotions these days? How are you taking care of yourself? How are you channeling that energy, if you are? Yeah, Valerie, go ahead. I promise I have a light question after.
I can't wait. I'm a big believer in anger as a sacred emotion. I have a real problem with people, and there are a lot of people in sort of the spiritual community and even like similar circles to ours, like who think that negative emotion is bad. Negative emotion, like there's such a thing, is bad, or it's attracting negativity to you or whatnot. I think anger is the most transformative emotion. So I really try to honor it in myself and with the women around me. That said, I tend to sometimes, when I need to just release it, it gets released on Joe Manchin's voicemail. There's a lot of that. Please do it every single day. You don't have to call your own senator. You can call other people's senators. And it's just great. Just annoy them as much as you can. Showing up, I feel like being in community with other people, whether that means rallies, whether that means volunteering for campaigns, or if that literally just means like having women's circles that are just open spaces where I invite the women in my life to come in and be like, bring whatever you have. Like, there's no rules except don't give unsolicited advice and don't steamroll people and don't tell them they can't be angry. You know what I mean? I have a... The last 2 years, one of the things that really helped me was as part of my theater company, Fundamental Theater Project, we're a nonprofit that's dedicated to helping immigrant artists here in New York. So we've taken a really political turn in the last couple of years. And So after the election, I started what's become an annual event where it's a different fundraiser every year. The first time it was for Planned Parenthood Action Fund New York. The second time it was for the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. But we put on like a concert that is like, it's protest songs or it's people writing spoken word pieces. It's mostly women. And it's become a really powerful way to not just feel like I'm doing something with the means that I have to raise money, to advance a cause, but also like to create the kind of sacred space where people can process those emotions. Yeah. So that's what I've been doing.
Has that happened this year yet?
No, that happens in early spring every year.
Okay. So people
in Brooklyn, New York. So follow my Instagram for whatever we do next year.
Yeah, that's great. Anyone else want to chime in on that?
Therapy.
Yes.
Sure. Jill.
I practice historical European martial arts.
I'm sorry, what?
Historical European martial arts. I practice longsword and do Spartan races, and I take combatives classes times a week.
Can I jump on that, though? Because I had the most amazing opportunity for a job at the beginning of the year to start training in Krav Maga. But that shit helps.
It does.
It's not just like as an... I don't know about you, but for me, it's not just like... I'm releasing my feelings. It also means that I move through space with a different kind of empowerment,
yeah.
Especially when I feel disenfranchised.
Yeah, and physical activity always helps clear your negative emotions, and it also is my social circle. I work out with a bunch of really badass ladies, and we run Spartan races together and stuff, and we flip tires, and it makes us feel better, and we all are exactly the same politically motivated type of women, and we run the gamut of binary, non-binary, like everybody. It's just like the most amazing group of people, and I think I would be despondent sometimes without having them around.
It's funny because I've been preparing to go back to professional wrestling school.
Oh my god. My next panel is the Headlock panel about wrestling and comics, and I'm on that too. So
it's a very similar thing. It's like it's like super athletic LARPing, mm-hmm. And it's like you've got that physical component, and I'm training to be a heel. I have this like idea I'm toying with how to do of just being like the crappiest. No, it's great. The crappiest heel ever, where I'm like a cop and I just get my ass completely smashed and handed to me, and like I'm like, oh no, and just like as a cathartic way to embody and mock the things that are pissing me off that day and channel that into being a heel.
And also fling your body off a top rope at someone.
All right, let's get to your questions. Yes.
My question is, if you were to have a witch familiar, or maybe you do, I don't know, what would it be?
Anyone who wants to jump in.
You can see my witch familiar. His name is Oberon, and I understood what a familiar went. What a familiar meant for the first time after having a bunch of cats my entire life, but I've never had one that is so possessive of me. And if you like me the best, he hates you the most. He's the most awesome, funny cat, but I've never had such a weirdo cat. And I went, I think you are a familiar because he perches on my shoulders. He likes to do everything I do. And my mother has said, I've never seen a cat look so pissed off because someone likes you. Like anybody comes by me, he's like, why are you near my thing? This is my human.
That's a good one. Zoe, what's your familiar?
I don't have a familiar, but after just hanging out with enough like cool queer people I adore and just not being mean to furries, I've been assigned a fursona, and I think that's basically the same thing. It was a fun bar argument because it was just out with a bunch of queer furry friends, and and I was just like, hey guys, how do you like figure that out? Is it like, do you decide?
Is it bestowed upon you?
Yeah, yeah.
And what animal you might be.
Right. I was like, what would mine be? And it became such a big bargument, they called in another furry to be like, you need to get here, we're trying to figure this out. And they... It is serious. Wow. They settled on a white mink because it's still like it can clean up well, but it's still like a goofy weasel at the end of the day. And I Google image searched it, and the first picture of it was one being like in the air. I'm like, yeah, that checks out.
So funny.
I think anyone who knows me,
sure.
The penguin, like.
Yeah, follow Heather on Twitter, and you'll see plenty of penguin pics.
See, what's really funny about that is, like, it's not in my profile. It's not like apparently I talk about penguins enough that if I say I'm having a bad day, complete strangers just send me penguin
That's
pictures.
Great. Heather, what is it about the penguin?
What is there not about the penguin?
You're right. Valerie, what's your familiar?
Oh, I feel like my urge is to, like, pick something that's really, like, powerful and violent, like, for, like, that revenge fantasy. So I feel like I should probably, like, a penguin. So I feel like I should err to, like, a koala, where they're just, like, chilling. Or, oh, no, bonobos. Bonobos. I want it to be bonobos.
Yeah. That's good.
Change my mind. Fuck the koalas. Okay.
Wow.
Am I allowed to say that? Don't really.
Pete is getting caught.
Familiars are a fun trope of witch stuff, and I have a character in Hexwives who is based on Sabrina, and I was like, well, she's got to have a cat. All the witches are sort of based on pop culture witches, but much darker versions, and I am a dog person. I have been raised with dogs. I have dogs now, and I feel like I've betrayed an entire species in writing this cat that I love writing. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
What are some of your, not necessarily favorite or least favorite, but just depictions of, or even just weird uses of the word witch, if for like a fictional character that just, the craziest that you think, that you've seen?
What are some crazy depictions? Which ones have you loved? I will also add to this, what was like your gateway witch? What were witches that sort of got you into witches and made you recognize that, oh, this is a cool kind of trope thing?
I think for me, my gateway witch was Samantha Stevens from Bewitched.
Good answer.
Growing up, yeah. I think for me, it was such a, you know, you grow up with the fairy tales, right? The wicked witch or the scary godmother or character that we see over and over in fairy tales. And Samantha Stevens was just this, like, perfectly 50s, you know, almost Stepford Wife type, but she was good witch, and it was just such a fun show, and she did her magic by, you know, tipping her nose, and I know I spent hours in front of the mirror trying to do that and couldn't understand why magic wasn't happening.
Do you want to plug my book while you're talking about Bewitched? Hexwives is, I've been pitching it as Bewitched meets the Stepford Wives.
I'm here for you, Ben.
I know, thank you. And I always liked Andorra. I preferred her mother.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because she was right. She was right that Samantha married beneath her.
Yes.
Well, immortal.
In both of those shows of the same time, I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched, both of those female characters had the evil cousins or whatever
yes,
they were.
That's right. Who
that were the ones that were kind of like, why are you limiting your power? And because I never understood why the dudes that they were in love with were like, I'm married a witch or I have a genie, and why, and I always tell her, don't use your powers.
Right.
So it was like, it was the ultimate, like, stifling of the powerful woman energy, right? It's like, she can do anything and actually do it for you too. And you're like, no, don't do that. And I loved Andorra. Actually, I just put a picture of Andorra on my Instagram like the other day because I realized Scary Godmother colors and Andorra are the same colors.
Yes.
And subliminally, I must have been like, I want to be Samantha, but I'm probably really Andorra.
I think we're all Andorras at heart.
My gateway witch was Sabrina.
Mm-hmm.
So you just mentioned her, and I was like, that was, especially Dan DiCarlo, first appearance of Sabrina. I love his artwork.
Yeah.
So my first love, my comics, was Archie Comics. And when Sabrina came out, that was another thing, like, that went on my list of things to be like, you know, Sabrina was on there, Cher, Madeline Kahn, Gilda Radner.
Yep.
So you're going to be writing the Sherry Godmother next.
The Sherry Godmother. Oh my God, if Cher wanted to voice the Scary Godmother in anything or be the Scary Godmother, I would just cry.
That's amazing casting.
Her voice should be pretty Scary Godmother-y anyway.
Yeah.
Cher listens to the writers.
She is. She's a big fan of this, of this podcast.
I'm sure she follows me on my social media because I follow her.
Zoe, what's your gateway witch?
So weirdly enough, like, my mom went like turbo born again Christian when I was younger, and it was like witches and stuff were very verboten, very suddenly, even though it's like this thing I'd grown up with. So I got snuck out with some older friends to go see Hocus Pocus in theaters.
Nice.
And I was like, I know they're the bad guys, but I want to be their friends. They seem really fun. I like all of these people, and they just, I don't know. I saw that. I was like, I want two other biddies to just stunt on some nerds with me.
Valerie.
Oh, mine's so not cool. If I really like go back to the beginning, I don't know if anybody remembers this. This is a different Fairuza Balk moment. It was the worst witch with Tim Curry.
Yes.
That was the best song in the world.
That song. That was like pre-Hogwarts, you know, witchcraft school. And I would try to like put together an outfit that was kind of like what she wore for her uniform. It was
so
not
much.
Cool. And I just remember like there was one specific day we had to go out, my brother had like a Boy Scouts thing or something, and my parents said I didn't have time to change, and I was just so embarrassed because I was dressed up like Fairuza Balk in the
But and now you
now
realize
I
how badass
it. It's fine.
That
it's
is.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. You weren't owning your witchiness yet. Yes, question.
Well, my question kind of perfectly segues into that in terms of visually throughout history, witches have run the gamut from Roald Dahl's The Witch to The Craft to Hocus Pocus to American Horror Story, all that stuff. So do you have either a witch fashion icon or like a visual like witch, just like kind of, yeah, like the, like Jill was talking about, just like the profile, like certain things that kind of align to witches that you identify with?
That's a great question. A witch fashion icon.
If Nicole Kidman wore it in Practical Magic, I want it.
Oh, yeah.
The sunglasses, those little colored round ones, so 90s, so good.
I like to joke that I frequently dress like an extra from The Craft, but if I had unlimited money and could just be opulent all of the time, it would definitely be Regina King in Once Upon a Time, because every single outfit, my God!
All right, I want to sort of race through the rest of these questions, so go ahead.
A little bit more heavy. Do you think that the current pop culture sensationalization of witches, do you think it has opened up a wider world for women to like take control of their autonomy, or do you think that it could potentially and might have already lead to a sort of commercialization and watered down set of ideologies? Sorry, that was so messy.
That's a great question.
That's a great question.
Anyone who wants to tackle it?
Do you mean like that Sephora thing that happened?
Oh yeah, I've heard about it. I don't know. I waffle back and forth on this because I feel like the more people see and even get a little bit of a taste of, you know, what might open them up to using their own personal power is kind of a good thing. But then I can also see how people who are practitioners of a certain magic or indigenous peoples who've had customs and traditions throughout, you know, ages in history would be like, oh, that's our thing. And you're, you know, grabbing it yet again from us. But I feel like we on this planet we're all like, everyone in this room is the same species. We're just like flowers. We're different varieties, shapes and colors of it. And because there's a through line that usually runs through all of these witchy, magic-y things that we may appropriate from other cultures or we find when we are discovering them, I feel like that means that if everyone has something that's almost really similar, mm-hmm. I feel like that there's the truth in it. So maybe we all should be drawing from it anyway.
I think for me too, it also just depends on like the story that's being told. Mm-hmm. Because like if using Redlands, for example, like our main characters are witches, you know, their father's the devil, but it's not about that. It's not about their magic. It's not about their powers. Very rarely do we actually see any of that happen. It's about, you know, it is about the justification of their anger in that story. And if I think, you know, if the hook of, oh, they're witches, brings you on to get that catharsis through that story, you know, cool. It opens your eyes to something new and hopefully brings something to yourself through that.
Yeah.
I think a big thing is, you know, do your research. When if you get it, I love introductory things to be like, oh, come be curious, learn more. But I think the next part of that is also uplift the people who have already been doing this for centuries. Go out of your way. If you have, like, you know, it should not just be about obtaining power for yourself. It's about uplifting and using that power to pass the mic and bring up other people who've never had it in the first place if you can. And but that's definitely one of the most powerful, magical things you can do.
And be very respectful always to the source from where you may discover something.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, because you don't want to be like that episode of Buffy where those frat guys like painted the thing for their Halloween party and then everyone, they actually lose all this terrible magic. I'm always worried that that's going to happen by accident. that someone will be like, oh, this is a really cool thing, let's use this. And then like, oh no, we have to stop this monster.
Right. I feel like I did that on accident.
Yes, what's your question?
Hi. Sorry if this is too broad, but I was wondering if you had any advice for female artists and creators who would like to break into the industry?
Yeah, we can answer that.
In what capacity are you looking to break, and which industry?
Yes.
I mean, we have a couple
have a
of, industries
of industries
on the
industries
table.
On
here.
The table.
I assume you mean
first
podcasts.
Piece of advice, plug your work right. First piece of advice, plug your work right now. You got a mic. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not published. That's the thing.
Are you a writer? Are you an artist?
I'm
are you
a writer.
Both? You're a writer? Keep writing. Write every day.
Do you want to write comics? Is that like...
I'm interested in writing comics. I'm interested in writing for TV shows, for video games, for books, for... I'm a very wide medium. I'm open to meet different mediums.
Well, the best part is, you know, you're in the best time to do that in this industry. It's free to put anything on the internet. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, self-promotion on the internet is out there. It's how I made my network and got my connections, and you can kickstart anything and put it out there. And being at events like this and just, you know, going up to people and talking to them, like finding an artist being like, yo, I like your art, let's talk about it. Mutual fandom is great.
And also, I mean, you have an editor here on the panel. I find when someone comes up to me and says, can you read my stuff? Because I'm an active creator, I'm always hesitant to read something somebody else did because I was like, oh, I might have a similar idea and I don't want anyone to think that I've like taken their idea. But editors are there to help you hone your craft and also to show you, it's like, okay, you're really strong in this, but you have to work at this part to just help bring your idea together cohesively. I think sometimes people think editors are just
like traffic
of
cops.
Things or managers, yes. But they're there to, a good editor should be able to tell a writer, it's like, you know, this, I think you're running on a little bit, or you might need to rein this character back in, and or to be able to help them find the focus if they're off track a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you might need that right now.
But yeah, to anyone, you know, in the audience or listening, you know, Jill's instinct, the first piece of advice she gave was just keep writing. Write stuff and then absolutely put it out into the world. Yes, what is your question?
Hi. Thank you so much for giving us an idea of how your past as people and practitioners have informed your work. How have the mechanics of your practices and works informed your depiction of magic and witchery?
Or have they?
Or have they?
Mine's kind of like definitely directly applicable in that learning how to be able to do stuff to the internet, and part which is a very real part of the world, is kind of like a way that my girl's powers work. You know, because like I think technology kind of is magic in that sense, and there is that old adage that technology sufficiently advances indistinguishable from magic. And it's also got like that whole not doing certain kinds of magic because it's like inherently negative is kind of true with how we train algorithms in AI. If you train them on negative garbage, they become reinforcing engines of negative garbage. And there's very similar practitioner tenets in that. And for me, like a lot of my practitioning stuff is like herbal traditions and stuff that's basically like medicine for people without health insurance, like writers like me. But that ritualization actually really helps with the fact that I have ADHD and PTSD, and ritual can really help break yourself out of negative cycles. Like, again, therapy for queer people do part.
Thanks.
When you're creating witchy content and looking for collaborators, what kind of issues do you run into and how do you overcome them?
Are you asking about like challenges specifically in the creative process?
Well, yeah, and like working with people and like finding the right people to work with, and like what kind of issues like do you come across when working with people that aren't necessarily really familiar with witches and witchcraft?
I don't know. I think for me, it's always just like when I cast someone or when I'm bringing talent on, it's I always keep the content in mind in general first. Yeah. It's, you know, like with Vanessa, when it came to Redlands, we literally just asked her, like, what do you think of this? And she's, I'm all for it. And so, like, you don't have an issue in, yeah, in that. What about you working with Robbie? I mean, what was Robbie's knowledge?
Robbie's great. We both kind of come from old school punk backgrounds, and Robbie's like super open-minded and chill and good with everything. And I mean, part of what I look for is someone who, it's what I'm not looking for, is like, you know, people who are very judgmental and be like, oh, so you're like into that woo-woo stuff, which is honestly, I'm starting to learn astrology just to piss off straight white boys. Oh, astrology is so dumb, but let me tell you what Hogwarts house I'm in, and let me tell you my MBTI type, and let me tell you all of this other stuff that's absolutely exact. It's like, oh, wow, that sounds like such a Sagittarius thing to say.
Oh, my gosh, you're so right. Let, ask them when they're, what, the time they were born, and they're like, are you doing an astrological chart on me?
Valerie, you were in this Blair Witch movie.
Yeah.
Was there a conversation with those guys, the writer, director, about like what is the witchiness of this?
Oh man, there were some things that came up on that set.
Why are we only getting to this with 40 seconds left?
I don't know. I'm like, I can't give this in 40 seconds. We didn't really so much talk about, like, you know, there was a kind of explanation in the most recent Blair Witch that I was in that was like about who she was. It gave this kind of like historical, you know, account in terms of persecution, but she's a real witch, but she's evil. I don't know. But like the witchy shit that happened on that set was like, oh man, the director.
Really?
Well, the director at one point, we were doing like the campfire scene, which we had to shoot like 3 days because we had to reshoot it many times. At one point, he thought it would be like atmospheric to start playing from like speakers in the woods, like Aleister Crowley doing invocation. Oh. And I was just like, well, it was funny because it's like, oh, no, me, no, and then no, the, no, the fundamentalist Christian actor were both the ones that was like, no.
Nobody wants that.
Like, it's just, let's not mess with that. And then, like,
goes
we
back
had
to the frat boys and, deciding to do this.
And then, like, a week later, we're still out there doing the campfire scene, and that's when, like, one of the women from catering decides to sit down in the tent and tell us that she believes that demons are attracted to horror movie sets because of the energy that we're raising and all that. While we're literally in the middle of the woods, like, base camp is way away. You cannot see the light. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing where it's just,
oh,
yeah.
Lord.
So there was a lot of stuff that came up for people. It was fun.
Awesome. Yeah, listen, we'll get you all back. We'll do another convention. We'll talk about all this stuff. Please give a round of applause to all of our panelists. Jill Thompson, Zoe Quinn, Heather Antos, Valerie Curry. Thank you for listening to the Writers Panel. Tune in next Tuesday and every Tuesday for a brand new episode. And in the meantime, please subscribe and review the Writers Panel on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app. And follow me on Twitter at Ben Blacker, just like it sounds. And let me know who you want to have on the show. The Writers Panel is a co-production of the Forever Dog Podcast Network and the ATX Television Festival. You can listen to more Forever Dog podcasts at foreverdogpodcast.com and keep up with the ATX Fest throughout the year at atxfestival.com. Thank you, and see you next week. Well, you'll hear me next week. Thanks for subscribing.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.